Hello and welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats. And our film for this episode is Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man. And from 1990, and we have it on VHS, getting it from Pleasant Dreams Records in Polish Hill, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Polish Hill, within the last week, because Dusty, one of the co-owners, I said, pick us out something interesting, and I went home with this VHS tape, and damn you, Dusty Hanna, for making me do this, but...
The pandemic has been hard on people. And
the pandemic has been very hard on people, and this film was hard on us, I think, watching it. So critical reception in 1990. I did not see this film when it was new. I was 13 years old, but I did not see it when I was new. I do remember some awards show, Damon Wayans said something about, you know, this is for comedy. It was some awards thing, maybe the MTV Awards or something. He's like, and this is for comedy. And, you know, these movies that are funny on purpose, unlike Harley Davidson, The Marlboro Man. That is what I remember about this film.
I think I vaguely remember, like, catching part of it on, like, HBO or Showtime or something like that. Maybe, like, in the mid-90s. But I've never, ever watched this whole film and had a vague...
Until tonight.
Knowledge of it, yes.
And I will say, in our research, because we do try to do a little... We watch the film, we kind of, you know, play on the internet for a little bit. And Gene Siskel and Ebert in 1990 or 91 had a Guilty Pleasures episode dedicated to films that they liked that no one else did. And Gene Siskel picked Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man as a movie that he liked that critics and audiences all hated. It was one of many.
Which was so weird for him. Of the two, like, for this was not the one I would think he would pick for his guilty pleasure, which completely shocked me.
Yeah.
Because he's the more stodgy of the two.
He is the more stodgy of the two, and I guess for him, I don't know, character and plot didn't make sense. Or didn't matter, maybe? Maybe it was just like, oh, it's an action film. And in my revisiting the film... So the thing that Dusty said was, don't watch the movie, just pay attention to the score. The really sad moments in the movie sound good. And he's not wrong.
However, it did open with Bon Jovi, Wanted Dead or Alive, which was hard
that for a boy who grew up in New Jersey to revisit that. I could go to my grave and never hear really any Bon Jovi song ever again, but I think that one is, and whatever ones, You Give Love a Bad Name, those two, like, those are the twin barrel sawed off shotgun to the face blast. But I think revisiting the film in the 2020s and thinking back to VHS 90s action movies, this film, well, so it came out in 90. So my initial thing when we saw it was like, okay, they decided to make a 90s action film, but they hadn't actually seen a 90s action film yet. They just had one kind of described to them. It's like, there's two guys and they kind of are friends, but it's like a rough and tumble, aggressive male friendship, and there's a love interest, and there's some larger than life, rich and powerful antagonist figure who, like, you know, is in a corporate boardroom or something, and he's really evil and they're doing bad stuff, and there's usually a really good friend, sympathetic minor character that bites it somewhere in the first third of the film, maybe at the halfway point.
And if that works for one, what if you have multiples?
And this was like, what if this works multiple? But they hadn't actually seen a 90s action film yet. They just got the description, and maybe they had never really seen a film before or had taken a film class and then shot this movie.
Well, like, it feels like they were like, did you ever see Blues Brothers? That's so much fun. Also, did you ever see Die Hard? What if we put, like, Blues Brothers and, like,
Die Hard and made it a Western?
And made it a Western. Because, you know, like, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
And you know what else? That was awesome. What if it was, like, Blade Runner 2 and it was set in the near future? So what if it was, like, a sci-fi Western Blues Brothers Die Hard action movie with Mickey Rourke and Don Johnson?
Is this like the Pearl Harbor of action films? Like, let's sprinkle in a little bit of everything.
You gotta explain that reference.
So the film Pearl Harbor,
the Michael Bay
Pearl Harbor, which was with the 2000s. If you've ever seen that film, the lead characters are literally involved in almost everything related to World War II. Like,
it were related to Pearl Harbor.
So
they're party boys, they are woken up by the bombings, they shoot down planes, they try to cut ships open to save guys' lives, they end up at the hospital, then they go on the Doolittle bombing raid.
Well, I think in the one brother does end up in, like, Europe fighting Nazis as well.
So they just get the whole World War II.
Everything that could possibly happen. And, of course, the brothers both fall in love with the same girl. Like, every possible trope
have. That's right. And there is a love interest in Harley Davidson. And it's also that 90s dopey trope of straight white men getting their dicks back.
Yeah.
They have to somehow reclaim their masculinity in the plot. Somehow they're emasculated and they get their dicks back by defeating the corporate boardroom shitty guy at the end of the film. By killing him.
So can we...
Sorry we spoiled.
Yeah, well, so anyway, the reference to Pearl Harbor is that, like, it does feel like any possible, it's almost like a garbage burrito. Any possible idea you could have had for an action film was thrown into there.
And it was what the action movie pieces left over at the end of the day go into the garbage burrito. It's like, we got pinto beans, nacho cheese, like a scoop of rice in there, a lot of guac, I don't know. But yeah, it is this so near future. And so then there's this, like, Breaking Bad stole it. There is this drug that's this new synthetic drug that people take through their eyeballs, man. And it's a big blue jello brick. And it's a heist film. Oh, and it's a heist film.
Yeah.
It's a heist film.
Well, it's like a stagecoach, right? Or robbing a train.
Robbing
almost kind
an
of
an armored car. Yeah.
So let's like pause for 1 second and start with the near future, because there's a lot that's going on in there.
Yes.
Let's start with the concept of the near future. So the film's 1990. They decide to set it in like 1996. I want to say
yes, came out in 91. So shot in 90, came out in 91.
So 96.
And they shove all of this in an hour 38 minute runtime.
So they decide near future is going to be 96. and for just two reasons, because nothing really futuristic is happening. This whole what was it called again? Dream, what was it called? I forget the drug.
The blue
is that what it was called?
That was how memorable. We watched this movie within 2
Crystal
hours.
Crystal Dream. Which is
we watch this movie like literally watch a minor league hockey game on a streaming app and thing. We're already forgetting key points.
Which looks
this movie.
Just like blue jello.
It is blue jello.
And so the Crystal Dream, so they could have Crystal Dream and the bad guys can wear our Kevlar jackets.
Yes.
I think that's literally the
and
only
so the two things
reason.
That yes. So that there is this weird looking synthetic drug, thank you, Breaking Bad. And then they're wearing this sort of dusters and pants from The Matrix.
But The Matrix didn't come out until 1999.
This movie, it really is futuristic and ahead of its time. And then, so it's the near future, but then you have these, like, very rough and tumble, old-fashioned masculine dudes. Harley Davidson, who's played by Mickey Rourke, who rides a...
Yamaha?
Harley Davidson. Oh, he rides a Harley Davidson.
That's right.
It actually says it on the gas tank of its print. It's like, you know for sure Harley rides a Harley. And then the Marlboro Man, who is played by Don Johnson, who's a cowboy. And Don Johnson plays a future cowboy. I just like to set those words.
Well, also,
and somebody at some point, because this movie had, we found out, what, a $20 million budget?
Yeah,
$20 million budget. Somebody who greenlit the $20 million was like, yeah, Don Johnson plays a future cowboy. And did not seem like the most absurd sentence any human being has ever uttered.
And also talk about, like, you know, just the cynicism of the product placement. So it's Harley Davidson, Marble Man. The Marble Man's love interest is Virginia Slim. There's their one friend's name is Jack, but his full name is Jack Daniels. And then their other friend is, what you call it, Jose Cuervo, that drink. So, like, literally.
Oh, man.
Literally. They just blame.
The people are products.
This was a joke on Wayne's World, but Wayne's World, the movie. This is literally, like, someone thought this was a great idea. Let's name five characters after these products.
Yeah. And we also have to mention that Tom Sizemore is in this film. He is the big corporate boardroom evil guy.
Yes.
Vanessa Williams is in this film.
Randomly.
And one of the lesser Baldwin brothers. Daniel Baldwin. Daniel. So a second tier Baldwin brother is also has a role in this film. And yeah, it's so dysfunctional. I think there's also this weird way that maybe is it that these products are also these American characters, like literally like you're shopping for identity. And these characters have shopped for identity. The pacing is super weird, especially in the early exposition part. Both Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man have these scenes where they're alone, where they get really violent and beat the crap out of people to prove how like rough and tough they are, but those scenes are really slow, and there's almost that, you know, this thing I heard John Wayne say once to a younger actor was always pause in the middle of your line so that if there's a line where the camera is right on you and you have to deliver it right to the camera, always pause so that you have that extra moment in the spotlight. That it's like that. Like, it's like, look, everybody. I mean, it almost reminded me of, like, bad English professors I had in the past who, like, taught their favorite book and, like, their pedagogy was, look how cool it is. Just look at it. You read this, right? Isn't this great? And it was like, they're, look, yo. Like, I mean, almost like the director was trying to, like, to the art, like, yo, that's the dude from Miami Vice. Yo, did you see Angel Heart? That's a good movie. We got Mickey Rourke for this. You know?
Yeah.
Which actually, weirdly, the best role of Mickey Rourke's career is St. Francis of Assisi. I don't know if you've seen that film, but actually, Francesco, Mickey Rourke is incredible in that film as St. Francis of Assisi.
Wow.
Sidebar. Anyway.
How random.
No, seriously, see Francesco. It is amazing.
Yeah.
With Mickey Rourke as St. Francis of Assisi.
That's the funny thing is Mickey Rourke can be such a good actor, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, Diner, Barfly, Angel Heart, if you like our Angel Heart.
Yeah.
Like, he can legit act. And in this movie, he was so funny in it.
Well, I think part of it for me is, because you think about other 90s action films and other 90s action films. I mean, can Arnold Schwarzenegger act?
No, that's
could
true.
Stallone act?
Yeah.
Could Seagal act? Could Van Damme speak English? You know, it was okay, but or Bruce, you know, I think the gold standard of 90s action film was still Die Hard, you know, which I think was earlier.
It was 88 or 89.
88, but still, it's the 90s. You know, just take the good parts of the 80s and put them in the 90s. You know, that character, the characters that they often played, even as the Terminator with Arnold Schwarzenegger, there is a personality there. There is something happening where there is a fully developed person who, you know, says witty stuff. 1991, the film that inspired this podcast that we haven't done yet, The Last Action Hero, came the year later.
Yeah.
Where Bruce Willis and Damon Williams have a bunch of funny one-liners. Yeah. They have the same guy needing to get his dick back, emasculation wound at the beginning of the film, that they reclaim themselves. All of that works, but they had lines.
Yeah.
They had lines. There were jokes that came out of their mouth, you know? I mean, even Last Action Hero goes meta and says, you know, if you hit somebody with a surfboard, you got to say something like, "Surf's up, pal," or whatever, you know, at the end of the film to be like, aha, you're smart in this. You've seen this film. You're seeing the film. I'm in on the joke, too, that
trope. There is one really, really funny moment.
There is an amazingly funny moment that you have to suffer through an hour and a half to get to. Maybe not an hour and a half.
Like, I think it's an hour and 20.
About an hour and 20 of just poop eating, you know, and the thing. You just poop on your popcorn. So I just think the script is just dumb.
Yeah.
I think that you know, if they had lines, I think that's the thing. I think Mickey Rourke did the best he kind of could. There was nothing between those two characters at all. Like, they were supposed to be these lifelong friends who would be willing to do anything for one another. But they don't seem to have any history.
Well, also, like, there's no, like, real background on them. Like, you don't even
know. Just kind of show up.
They're kind of like drifters who can afford a Harley Davidson.
And perfect hair.
And perfect hair.
And though they never change their clothes are always perfect. I mean, there is that TV movie quality.
Yeah.
To it, which, of course, is maybe fitting because the director of Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man directed Lonesome Dove. That's thought to be perhaps the greatest made-for-TV movie. So there is that element. Yeah, they're drifters. They have these hard lives, but they're like... And they always get in fights, but they're... I mean, Don Johnson's beard is, like, perfectly coiffed.
Well, I mean, he is, like, a millennial. Like, he has that kind of hipster look. Like, if you plopped him in our neighborhood at a coffee shop, people would be like, damn,
he's super hot. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the plot a little bit. Because I think...
Let's break down
this. And I'm going to say... I'm gonna call this parallel thinking because... As we're watching the film, I made a comment that Roger Ebert made after we watched the movie. Matt watched Roger Ebert talk about
Watch the Guilty Pleasure special.
So as Matt said, it starts with them each one separately getting into like a fight, so you can see how tough they are.
Long scenes. There's like a setup to the Don Johnson's fight has like a super long setup.
They go to their favorite bar where they kind of would hang out and were kind of young, rough and tumble guys there. And the bar is going to be closed because they owe the bank $1 million.
Well, because of gentrification.
Yeah.
Somehow the guy signed a 30-year lease for no money.
Yeah.
And then suddenly now the bank wants millions of dollars for a 5-year lease up front.
Right.
To drive them out, which is also ahead of our time. I mean, that's Pittsburgh 2020, or maybe gentrification finally trickled down to Pittsburgh.
But you know, that happens.
And so owe, like, $2 million.
And so they decide, why don't we rob a bank?
Why don't we rob the bank?
The bank.
That owns the property.
And we'll use
Because banks are also landlords.
And so
in the future, 1996.
So we'll rob the bank.
We'll rob the armored car
and their armored car and give the money to our friend.
We'll give the money back to the bank.
Because that sounds like a brilliant idea. Like, they're not going to put two and two together. They're not going to be like, wait, yesterday
somebody
you didn't
have. Somebody stole $2 million. Somebody in here is with $2 million. Well, actually, no, it was $2.3 million. It was, like, precisely the right amount. Somehow they knew there was going to be $2.3 million on this armored car.
Yeah.
And so, that they were going to, like, show up. Maybe they would put it in different bags, I guess.
So, like, you know, that's the best way to help save your friend's bar.
So that's the Blues Brothers element of it. was like, we got to save this place that was nurtured and cared for us.
Exactly.
And the thing is so the exposition, those two exposition scenes, and then there's like, they come back to the bar and there's this also long fight sequence because there's this guy who is like the arm wrestler for the bar. Then they bet on arm wrestling in this secret back room, and this guy, you know, hates Mickey Rourke's character, the Harley Davidson character, because he stole his girl or something. And so they get in this long fight, and then they're cool with it.
Yeah.
Though they literally tried to kill each other.
Yeah.
And while they're trying to kill each other, of course, there is, you know, both Don Johnson's Marlboro Man character is like, oh, yeah, this is tough to watch. You know, he's detached. He's cool and detached while his friend is about to be murdered.
And he also randomly knows sign language. Let me just put that in there.
Yes, because there's a deaf doorman.
Yeah.
And he knows sign language. You're right.
Yeah.
And so then there's this long fight sequence. And then there's the long, like, okay, man, I forgive you, man. You know, like, makeup sequence. And they're cleaning up. And there's, like, you know, they get thrown through a window into a convertible car or whatever. Through the roof of a Cadillac convertible. And so there's this big gaping hole in the bar, and nobody's like, oh, yeah, well, guys, we should clean that glass up. I mean, there's no window, or, you know, whatever you're going to do. And they make up, and then they just decide in, like, literally 30 seconds, oh, you need money? Let's rob the bank.
And
everybody's in on it.
Even the guy who he was just fighting with is in on it.
Even the guy who they were fighting with is in on it suddenly, immediately. Oh, yeah, rob the bank. Yes, let's commit a major felony. This will be fine. This will be good. Okay. And then, like, it's also an example of, for anybody who's want to write a screenplay, a play script, a short story, novel, whatever. You know, when you're writing dialogue, you cannot make the character say exactly what you need them to say to advance the plot and nothing else. And there are parts in this film, as slow as it goes, where the characters only say exactly what you need them to say, and it's so transparent at that moment in the film to advance the plot, and they say it pretty directly.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then you move on. And so, like I said, there are no characters in this film. There's caricatures.
Oh my gosh. This is so true. Because even, like, I keep coming back. Like, so, with Don Johnson's character, the Marmol Man, you get, like, these slight glimpses. Like, he's wearing these boots that his dad gave him. It's the only thing his dad gave him. And he, one time, did rodeo. But, like, there's really nothing, like, backstories for these guys. So
no backstory in Harley. At least for Die Hard. I was fixing bikes, you know. Yeah, at least with Die Hard, you have the ex-wife, you have the struggle. Even the Reginald Vell Johnson character has this, like, real emotional thing that he's going through.
I mean, even, like, Commando with Arnold Schwarzenegger, at least you get a freaking backstory for him.
Yeah, and again, not great actors, but again, these guys that look like they could... there seem to be some physicality to these roles.
Yeah.
They do minor stunts. Or they look like they could take that punch, or they could be thrown through that window and fight back still, you know, because that's what you need to be a male action hero. You need to be able to look like you can take a punch and look like somebody bigger than you could beat the crap out of you. Again, Bruce Willis being the perfect male action hero, almost in that sense. But at least give that guy a line.
Yeah.
I mean, I even think about something as awful as sudden death.
Mm.
Again, the Jean-Claude Van Damme character has a significant backstory.
Yeah.
And a reason to be there, and a reason to be in that situation, and a reason that he has to, as a protagonist, overcome something. These two guys are not protagonists. They don't change. They're the same guy in the beginning and the end, except all their friends get killed, and then they kill Tom Sizemore, and then they go their separate ways again.
Yeah.
So there's no... And as cheesy as the backstory in a film like Sudden Death is, It's like Die Hard in a hockey arena, you know? Or actually, I mean, you think the Steven Seagal one, it's like Die Hard on a boat, you know? Yeah. It was like, that was the pitch line. And they were like, yeah, let's put that on the movie poster in the commercial. So you just know what you're buying.
Yeah.
This film, no, these guys are just, yeah, and they just, they don't even have anything that funny to say.
No, and so, so let's get back to the contrived plot. So they rob the armored car, but it turns out it's full of the drug Crystal Dream.
Crystal Dream.
And so now they're caught up, because, like, they
And you don't ever see anybody use Crystal Dream.
Well, you don't ever see anyone use it, and also,
But it's supposed to be the new drug that kills everybody, but everybody loves.
And also, like, beyond, like, that they, which, you know, just, like, all it's used for is that they, instead of getting money, they accidentally get the drug. So it could have been any drug. It could have been, like, a new strain of cocaine. Like, there was no
need. You could have just gotten some Pillsbury flour. You could literally just had bags of flour. And you're good.
There was literally no need. And it, like, also, like, even the bad guys aren't addicted to it. So, like, you could even be like, oh, okay, it's this new super drug that makes you superhuman. Nope.
Nope. Which, I wonder if this was in development for a long time, or if this was a script by committee, or if this had been workshopped a lot. And if at some point ideas came into the script, and then ideas came out of the script, and though the scene, the character that was hooked on Crystal Dream, who was somehow trying to help them or something, got cut out of page 36, but you didn't. Then when you cut the Crystal Dream character you needed for the Crystal Dream to work out of page 36, you forgot on page 16 to cut Crystal Dream out. Like, you forgot, you erased one, you threw away one page.
Yeah.
But you forgot to check the script for the other pieces. And so there is this element of the film where there's all of these kind of loose ends. It's not even like that the movie's smart enough that it was a red herring. No, you just added on future drug.
Yeah. Well, it's also too, like, they're stagnant characters. So, like, they get the money, they get the drug, they realize what happened, and then they make a deal with the bad guy for him to pay them money to get the drug back. And, like, there's no, like, at any moment in time, like, it's kind of pretty bad that we're making this deal that will allow the drug to be back on the street.
Yes. Because we got to save this bar.
We got to save. So for
which
me,
even after the owner of the bar, the owner's son.
Yeah.
And everybody else who works at the bar all get murdered.
Because of the involvement.
In the final scene, or the penultimate scene, where Tom Sizemore bites it. Sorry if this is a spoiler alert. Don't watch this film. Okay, don't watch this film. It's not even amusing. It's not even like we've been watching some of the Joe Bob Briggs Shudder Last Drive-In stuff. Yeah. And like a movie like Blood Harvest, the Tiny Tim serial killer movie where he basically plays Ed Gein. There's at least a sense of fun to that movie.
Yeah.
This doesn't even have a sense of fun. Even in that scene, they're like, well, you gotta, like, you know, forgive the lease on the bar. It's like, no, all your friends are dead. The place has been shot up.
Yeah.
There is no bar anymore. There's no bar to go back to. There's no friends to hang out with. But they're still like, you gotta fix the bar, man. He's like, no, business is business. And it's just like,
yeah,
we're out.
So it's a really bad. For me,
and it's not even a fun bad movie.
So for me, because there's like no redemption for these guys, like, at least they could have set the premise that, you know, like, these drug dealers are trying to force this bar owner out of his space, and they're trying to get money, shake him down for money.
No.
And they come along to save the day. No. They kind of mess up everything. They get all of their friends killed. I don't think they were even smart enough to think of to take the money with them after they killed the bad guy. They're just kind of, you know.
Yeah, and so, like, the one friend has the girlfriend that they're into. Also, you know, they never, like, set things right with her because they're married. Actually, no, they're married. They're trying to start a family. Nope, he gets killed. They don't, like, oh, well, you need this. You know, they should have given her the suitcase full of money or something.
Yeah.
Nah. It's just some things that happen and some people who are completely unaffected by it.
But I will say they look very pretty throughout the movie.
Their hair is perfect in every scene.
Very, very pretty.
Even as they're running through the desert, even as they're on the back of a train, even, well, the scene when they jump into the hotel pool off the roof of the high-rise hotel, their hair, they get wet. But it's perfect the next day.
It is.
Like, you know, they had time while they're on the run from these bad guys who are tracking them to, you know, get into the barbershop and, you know, get everything taken care of. And
so if you're like, don't care about plot, don't care about character development, don't care about characters, and just want
things, one really funny scene
and things blow up,
it's and people getting shot a lot.
This is the movie for you.
Yeah, that is the 21% of Rotten Tomatoes that like.
I will say, after watching this movie, I said I would rather rewatch Roadhouse again.
Again, Patrick Swayze's character in Roadhouse is a full character. Has quirks, has traumas, has a thing that they need to fix, has a different way of seeing the world.
Yeah.
You think he even goes in and says, be nice, you know, it's like, he's like, let's have a command of the public space, whatever. No, these guys are just, they go and shoot things. There's a cool scene where a guy comes in on a motorcycle and he, you know, slides the bike, but he flips the gas tank open, which leaves a gas trail, and then he lights the gas trail on fire. So there's like this motorcycle sliding. The other thing about it is, and this is part, I think, the revisiting the movie in the 2020, and the way also there is a certain xenophobic get their dicks back quality, because apparently it's the, you know, the Tom Sizemore character speaks Japanese. There's apparently some foreignness perhaps to this drug, that there is this like, and again, the Tom Sizemore character is the new male character. He's finance, he's capital.
Yeah.
He speaks Japanese, he's educated, and you have the two clever guys. And we've always, all we going back, I mean, if you listen to the history of silent film, like the Douglas Fairbanks character was always the action, the man of action.
Yeah.
You know, Douglas Fairbanks, in one of his movies, if he walked in through the door, he's going out that room in the, at the end of that scene through the window, and vice versa.
Yeah.
You watch a Douglas Fairbanks silent film, he never goes through the same door twice, right? It's always, he can always take control of the situation with his physicality.
Yeah.
And his masculine physicality. And that's what these characters are. And I think it's very interesting seeing that now, you know, the 80s, the 90s, certainly in the 2000s with tech, you know, the man who's maybe clever and can use his hands and be successful and be okay. In the real world, it's harder and harder for those guys. Mm-hmm. Those guys need a degree, a certificate, an apprenticeship, something, some additional knowledge and some new way of existing in the new economy, you know, which has, I think, led to a lot of our reactionary politics and all of that. And so you also have this interesting, I think, that element, and seeing, again, the world where, you know, those people who were successful in the old world or maybe didn't think they need an education to be smart or whatever, or successful, those people are raging and reactionaries and wantonly destructive now. And these films, those are our two protagonists, not that they're protagonists.
Yeah.
Because they don't change. Which is also kind of interesting and weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also like, there's a lot of strangeness to the film. And even for me, like, you know, sometimes films will take me out of it. Like, if I feel like, I'm going to say the example, like, for me, Us took me right out of it. And
the giant fucking plot hole.
That literally, that film took me out within the first 3 minutes, because if there was this super secret government experiment, wouldn't they at least have a lock on the door?
Yes.
And well, that, well, for me, took with me Us out.
Is the trope, the stupid trope of the sleeping security guard.
Yeah.
who's watching TV, who's slumped over, old man. That's a 20-second shot.
So
where they sneak past that guy. Yeah. And you're like, all right, okay, I'm with
you. I knew exactly what the premise was. Like, I knew exactly what happened immediately. Yeah. So I think for this also, so that when I'm watching a film, even if, like, they make a stupid choice, but it's within the logic of the character, I'm okay with it. But if it's just, like, a stupid choice, like a stupid concept.
It's a stupid choice.
Like, for me, like, So we're meandering, just like the plot's meandering. Yes. So they rob the armored cars, they get the drugs, they make a deal with the bad corporate guy. In exchange for money, they give him the drugs, but his henchmen show up at the bar, shoot up everybody to get the money back. However, the Marble Man and Harley Davidson escape with the money, but everybody else is killed. And their decision is they barely make it out alive. They go to Vegas. Why would you go to Vegas? Like,
well,
they
the
keep
plane
making...
went to Vegas. So there was this contrived thing where they end up in the cargo hold of a plane, which is not pressurized. They wouldn't have survived that.
Yeah.
With a person they kidnapped and a corpse.
Yeah.
And they somehow get away from the airport.
Completely fine. This is pre-9/11.
Pre-9/11, obviously. But also, there's no explanation. They're just in a hotel in Vegas. It's like literally dead, like other baggage handler gets shot up by the henchmen. They have to load the dead guy into the cargo hold of the plane where they are with this person they kidnapped. Next scene, jump cut, they're in a hotel in Vegas.
Yeah.
And like, how did they get out of that situation? Which, again, the Douglas Fairbanks film, you always know how he got from one place to another because they bothered to do that. Yeah. Which, again, makes me think is like, was there more script? Was there more subplot? Was the Vanessa Williams character subplot tied up somehow?
Yeah.
Ugh, you know, there's all these loose ends. I mean, it's almost like Funny People.
Yeah.
You know, where there's just... Or The Room.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's how much of a failure this film is, you know. I sometimes teach film art, and I always have said, except for all the nudity, I would love to show The Room, because it makes everything in a film transparent. Mise-en-scène, props, character development,
costuming.
Dialogue, costuming, things in films that even in bad films, most of you don't think about, like, in a bad movie, you don't think about props.
Yeah.
And you rarely think about costuming unless it's a period piece or something. This film, there's like 45 seconds of nudity as opposed to the like extended Tommy Wiseau ass shots in The Room.
Veiny ass shots.
I almost could show this film as like, let's think about plot and character development.
Yeah.
And props and mise-en-scène. And everything else, because it doesn't function.
Yeah.
You know, instead of showing the great films that function, that all those elements, you have to really think your way into them because they're almost invisible. It almost, like, would be interesting to show a bad film. I could potentially do that lesson with Harley Davidson and the Barb Obra.
Yeah.
It's that much of a dysfunctional film. So I think, we've been talking long enough. So it's time for the big five questions on our way out of here. Question one, is the film camp retro classic or just an old movie?
It's just an old movie. It's just a bad old movie.
We've been talking a lot. Question two, what about the social political distance?
So
again,
this is interesting for me, though. Like, so female characters in this literally have no point other than to prove...
The male characters don't have point.
Well, the female are
but
even
the female
worse.
Characters at least look pretty. Actually, the men look pretty, too.
Well, so for me... So I'm just going to mention two things. First of all, though, it's interesting. So Vanessa Williams is just briefly in the movie as a former love interest of Mickey Rourke's character. But she is married now to his friend. And so that's just actually interesting for that time that it was an interracial couple.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually, oh, that's kind of cool, an interracial couple. However, like, that's it. She sings a couple songs. She's just briefly his love interest. There's nothing else that happens with her in the movie. And then, of course, there's the...
She disappears from the film. She
disappears. And there's Marble Man has a cop, a female cop that he had a on and off relationship with. And she's engaged now to...
Another cop.
Another cop. The thing for me...
Who also disappears from the film.
Who doesn't? But the thing that's funny to me is that... you know, Will Ferrell made the bromance very safe in his films. And there's a bromance element to this, but I feel like the women are there just as a reminder that they're not gay. It's a, for me, it's a no homo moment. Like, that's what it is. Like, that's what it feels like. It's like, well, we're super close. We spend all this time. We have this love for each other. But man, I've slept with a bunch of women. Vanessa Williams was a love interest.
Yeah.
I'm going to sleep with this woman. So I feel like the women are just props to show that they are definitely heterosexual males. Because
which, again, males cannot be... Whole thing I say, you know, if you're writing dialogue or, I mean, anything with a narrative... You can't have the characters say and do necessarily exactly what you need them to do all the time. Or that their purpose in the story is... And yeah, the women have a very clear purpose. Especially since, you know, well, it's also a bromance with no affection. No chemistry between the... which is a weird thing. I remember thinking this in the one scene where they're on the hotel roof getting shot at. And they're like, no, don't do that. That's stupid. And it's like... Wow, there's no chemistry in this bromance.
Well, actually, Mickey Rourke says, take my hand. And Doc Jones has said he'd rather get shot.
Which is also a no homo moment. Yeah.
But I will say, because I started so checking out of this movie, I just started believing that Tia Carrere, who plays the bad guy's kind of whatever pretty thing that's around the office with him.
Oh my god, yeah, does she even have a line? No, she has one line.
She has one line, which is a sexual innuendo that she gets. So I was just like, oh, this was just her stepping stone to becoming the super villain in True Lies, to become the villain in True Lies. So she just kind of interned with Tom Sizemore in this movie. And then a few, like 4 years later, she got True Lies, where she plays the villainess in that. So, you know, that's what I wanted to believe, that she was interning with him at that particular moment.
You don't get a character. Interns don't get characters.
But the role of women is none in this film, other than that they're kind of there as scenery and eye candy.
Sexual objects who prove that the male characters are definitely heterosexual and definitely... virile and masculine.
I will also say, because it's a 90s film, I was shocked that the drug dealers were not Hispanic, just to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I like think for me, there is that trope that is very common in, if you're a drug dealer, you are most likely
from
Colombia or, you know, and that kind of thing. And so like, or you're Mexican, or you're from Mexico. Like,
or you're just vaguely brown.
You're vaguely brown. And I think at least
you speak Spanish and
that kind of didn't happen. Which surprised me, just to be honest with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So the technical distance of the film, I think, and this is in the films, question three.
Come on, the near future.
They had a Chevy Caprice, the 90s last generation Chevy Caprice classic with tinted windows.
Yeah. I mean,
there was a helicopter, and there was these blue bricks in Ziploc bags.
The Kevlar duster jackets, don't
the
forget.
The Kevlar duster jackets.
And the tiny sunglasses.
Yeah,
that's...
And also the other thing you could say, at least about in terms of effects, I mean, this was, I was remember seeing the scene when they jump off the hotel roof. It's not a CGI, there is a CGI scene in the film, early, like, sort of green screen thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, it was of the era when action movies were physical stunts.
Yeah.
So lots of physical stunts, lots of car driving or motorcycle driving physical stunts.
You know what, though? The funny thing I will say, now that you bring that up, though, like, so Daniel Baldwin, the lesser Baldwin, literally just kind of stands around and stares and shoots guns. There's, like, no hand-to-hand combat or anything like that.
Yeah.
Just to be honest with you.
When the bad guys are chasing them, there's a bunch of punching early in the film.
Yeah, but, like, when you get to the legit bad guys,
They just have lots of guns.
They just have lots of guns. And at the very end, I think there's a couple, like, jabs, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of weird when you think about it. But I think for it being set in the near future, there's nothing futuristic.
Oh, and the cop bike is very kind of retro futuristic.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's the Robert Hughes thing from Shock of the New. Nothing dates faster than our vision of the past. And
Vision of the Future, you mean.
Vision of the Future, yes, sorry. Oh, I blew the line. Yeah, Robert Hughes, great art critic, Shock of the New. Nothing dates faster than our vision of the future. And yeah, that film was dated probably when it was new. Question four, we've been talking about this a lot, the room test. Yeah, there's just a lot that's broken, and you notice things that are broken in the, you know, it's one of those things, it's like with your car, you probably don't think about your coil pack ignition, and you might not know what a coil pack ignition is, but if your car won't start in the morning, you know, the mechanic will say coil packs. There's always coil packs and catalytic converters and all of those parts of a film, again, that usually just function or are invisible, and they just, oh, okay, I can absorb this scene and get a moment of, oh, this is, you, even if you want to be like, you know, Scott, oh, this is the exposition, you know?
Yeah.
It literally, like, grabs you those two scenes of, this is the exposition, you know? Like, I mean, it is so in your face.
Yeah.
I accidentally muted it when I did that. But the exposition, you know, and then this is the plot twist, you know, and then, yeah, everything, and the people are all also devices.
Yeah.
I mean, the scene, actually, when you go at the bar and the old owner and you're like, nope, yeah, he's the guy getting killed.
Yep.
He's getting killed. They're going to do this and he is going to get killed.
Yep.
That's how this is going to work.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, is it a keeper? Question five.
I mean, we keep everything, but no. I don't think I'll rewatch this one ever again. I think
this movie might end up back at Pleasant Dreams. I have to do a vinyl call in a little bit, and they sell VHS, and this might just end up back in that box, actually. So, if you want to, you might, and like, I'm not even taking the price sticker off. And Dusty will give me a couple bucks for it. So it was a rental. It was a long-term rental.
So the one thing that I will find fascinating about it is just the intersection of Don Johnson and Mickey Rourke. Because you had Mickey Rourke, who had been having a very successful career, and this is definitely the nail in the coffin to his career. I mean, he's had a recent resurgence, but that wasn't until, gosh, almost Sin City, which is over a decade later, that maybe 20 years later, where he finally gets a second chance. And then Don Johnson trying desperately to finally have a film career, which never took off for him.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these two guys who are desperately trying to crawl, you know, like, oh, this is going to be it. This is going to be it. This is going to be the big one. And it doesn't happen. I find it fascinating for that reason. But I will never watch this movie ever again.
Yeah. Yeah, same. I've done my time.
It's bad.
It's bad. Back to the lake with you, Nessie. is the way we go with that. And on that note,
that's a wrap.
Bye, everybody.